Hi, I'm Dave Reinersman. Welcome to The Marvels of Science, a new podcast about the science and tech of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All your favorite heroes and villains from Arnim Zola and Bucky Barnes to the Red Skull and Captain America. Speaking of the professional Boy Scout, today's topic is the Capsicle himself. Here with me to help us figure out how we survive being frozen 70 years in the Arctic is our science expert. Today, Don Larson is an assistant professor in the Biology and Wildlife Department of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who has extensively studied the Alaskan wood frog. And I promise that's way more relevant than it sounds at first glance. Thanks for coming on, Don.
Thank you for having me.
And our color commentator is Adam Correa, who is now a friend of mine in DC and used to be a friend of mine in Philly, and originally was just this guy married to a friend of mine. I asked Adam to be on this episode in particular because he spends so much time in the cold, a week, a year, camping in Wyoming. It's a thin connection, but it's a connection. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thanks, Dave. Pleasure to be here.
Let's hear it for Captain America!
Captain America!
Captain America.
Captain America.
Captain America.
Captain America.
Captain America.
Captain America. Captain America.
Who are you supposed to be?
Captain America.
Captain America. At the end of the first movie, he heroically crashes his plane in an unspecified spot in the Arctic Circle, saving dozens of U.S. cities from attack. It's unclear why he had to crash the plane rather than just go somewhere else, but he did. His contemporaries think he died in the crash, but some 70 years later, he is discovered, very much alive, but frozen solid.
You might have missed a couple things. Doing time as a capsicle.
Once thawed out, he's ready to save the world a few more times from a corrupt government again, an army sent by Thanos, and an army sent by Thanos, again, taking a little time out to record motivational lectures for high schoolers.
So, you got detention.
He has a niche. He is none the worse for wear. Adam, this is a weird question, but you've been cold, right? Camping in the Northwest U.S. must kind of revolve around temperature regulation a lot, right?
It does, indeed.
What's that like?
Biggest thing I can say about being in cold is you need to be prepared for it. I don't know if that's something that Cap had the opportunity to do before he crashed into the ice. But, you know, that, also being a native New Englander, I think being prepared is the most important thing, and making sure you have lots of layers and ability to start a fire. When we do our mountain backcountry camping and go, you know, up at 10,000, 11,000 feet for 7 or 8 days, it's just about being prepared and making sure you have the proper insulation.
And Don, when I asked Adam to join, I hadn't actually yet discovered that you live in Alaska. My context for Alaskan life is limited probably just to Stereotype and that one Ryan Reynolds, Sandra Bullock movie. So tell us, how much of your life revolves around the cold?
Well, the cold is what I study, actually. I study how animals overwinter, but it's also a big part of my day-to-day routine. We start getting below freezing around September, and then we thaw out sometime in April and May. So most of my activities and sports also revolve around cross-country skiing, hiking in the cold, playing with my kid outside, sledding, building forts. We also have a wood-fired hot tub we always fire up basically from September all the way until April to stay warm and have some fun outside as well.
A wood-fired hot tub. That sounds great.
Oh, it's wonderful because you just kind of get into this just nice big giant tub outside that's at a nice warm temperature, and you duck your head underwater and then you pop back up, your beard and hair freeze almost instantaneously if it's cold enough, negative 20 or so.
Those numbers are just unacceptable. I am a wimp when it comes to the cold. Adam, when you start to get very cold, what's the first thing you notice? Like, let's say you haven't been as prepared as you should have been on your camping. What do you first notice when you've crossed some sort of threshold into, oh no, I'm worryingly cold?
Probably start to lose feeling in your appendages, your fingers and toes. That's usually a sign that you want to maybe take a break and warm yourself up a bit.
Adam, let's try to be charitable to the science of the capsicle. What's your best in-universe explanation for how Captain America survives being frozen for 70 years?
So, having done some very cursory internet research on kind of like the concept of cryogenics,
okay,
I know that we can freeze certain things and bring them back to life, essentially because they're fairly simple. But a human being is very complex. It's filled with water. There are lots of problems that can occur. There are different parts of the human body that would freeze differently. So to me, the one plausible way is if somehow it could have happened really quickly.
Oh, okay. I was thinking like his special biology because of the super soldier serum, but maybe the circumstances around the freezing itself. I hadn't thought of that. There's also my theory that I developed just today. The super soldier serum rewrote his DNA to make him part frog. We're going to get to that. Don, this might be outside your area a little bit, but what would happen to one of us normal humans, not so much with the super soldier serum, as we freeze? We'll get to the frog in another moment. You gotta tease the audience before giving them the really juicy stuff like frogs.
Well, we do freeze. It's called frostbite, and it's when our tissues die. So it's really important to point out, though, why tissues die and why we die when we freeze. And it's because of a lack of water availability. When things freeze, we're removing water and turning it into a solid that's no longer accessible to us. The things that don't freeze, though, are all the solutes, all the molecules surrounding our cells, like the sugars and different proteins and different things we use to function. When we have too high concentration of those things outside our cells, like if you were to put a grape in salt water, it shrivels up.
Okay.
The same thing happens to our cells as we freeze. We're just physically taking water away, and that increases solute concentrations around our cells, and that causes the cell to shrivel and eventually burst from that shriveling.
The problem in my head, it was that the water inside the cell freezes and bursts the cell from the inside as it expands, but it's actually, you're saying, dehydrating the cell and pulling the water into whatever's outside the cell?
Yep, that extracellular space. And yeah, that what you're saying is a very common misconception of freeze tolerance and why freezing works. So in order to survive freezing, you have to prevent that water loss. It's a very simple thing that we're unable to do. We can't put water back in the cell, or we can't put more solutes in our cell to prevent that water loss. Once we have that, then we have to worry about intracellular freezing. But first thing we have to worry about is desiccation.
Wow.
It seems so counterintuitive, because we tend to think of, you know, like a soda can. If you freeze a soda can in your freezer, it bursts. So we tend to think of that kind of image, but nope, it's a dehydration event. So all of these animals that survive freeze tolerance and freezing have these adaptations to be desiccant tolerant during freezing.
Okay.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Oh, it's the best kind.
But in the human body, for example, there, you know, obviously is a lot of water. So when that water does have to freeze, and it's going to form crystals, is there a danger related to that as well, in addition to the desiccation?
Long after the desiccation kills us.
Got it.
Oh, so the frozen water will burst structures and things, but well after I'm dehydrated and dead.
Yeah. So when you think of, what's it in DC right now, right around 30?
Something like that, yeah.
So you go outside and there's slush right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have, right at freezing, you have both water, liquid water and frozen ice. And that's what our cells are experiencing at first, a slush, basically. They're not experiencing just an ice cube. It takes us a long time to get to that ice cube part. We're in that slush when we start to freeze.
Gotcha. Interesting. That's totally counterintuitive to me.
It's an incredibly common misconception. It's something that when I talk to other PhDs, they have that misconception as well. So it's a very well-known misconception that us in cryobiology talk about quite a bit.
And now it's time for that classic game, who can do it better, Adam Correa or the concept of natural selection? I might actually insert some game show music right there. Adam, design for us, please, a frog that is able to survive being mostly or completely frozen for long periods of time, now that we know some of the basics of why freezing kills.
The only straw that I'm grabbing at right now is that its cells have to be able to be resistant to that desiccation process.
Keep going.
That's all that's coming up. The other thing that comes to my mind is, and I don't know the answer to this, are they actually frozen, or are they in a state where the cold around them doesn't have the same negative effect that it would to you or me? So in other words, are they in a deep sleep type or hibernation?
And now we turn to our answer board. Don, how did he do? How does the Alaskan wood frog and others like it, I assume it's not the only one, actually do it? What's the secret?
So Adam's on the right track. We are talking about preventing that desiccation as the initial step. And so what they do is, you know, how do you prevent if you have a high solute concentration outside your cell, you balance it by putting a high solute concentration inside your cell. And they use two things, urea, urine basically, and glucose. Urea they make in preparation for winter. And this is what a bunch of other freeze tolerant animals do, is they prepare their what we call a cryoprotectant, that molecule that's going to protect you from freezing. But wood frogs are very odd in that they also only make their second cryoprotectant, glucose or sugar, in response to freezing. So a cryoprotectant is any of these very simple, low weight molecules, things like alcohols or urea or glucose that we can easily get into the cell. And wood frogs make copious amounts of glucose, sugar. So like in that little tiny frog body of something that weighs a few grams, maybe up to 8-10 grams, we have a sugar packet worth of sugar floating in their blood. In comparison, I am an adult male, weigh about 190 or so. I have about that much sugar in my blood right now.
Wow.
So these guys are sweet enough where if you were to lick one, it would taste sweet to you. It's about as much sugar concentration wise as what we see in sodas. So they're packing their cell with just all this sugar to prevent that water from leaving. And then they can let all that water outside the cell freeze, and the inside of the cell remains unfrozen. And they can do this they survive up here from October all the way to April, 6 months, 7 months.
I'm wondering though, I mean, I assume this is going to sound obvious. I'm assuming that amphibian biology is different from mine, but that sounds like super diabetes. That's an incredible concentration of glucose. So I don't know how the pancreas of the frog, if they have one, works. So is there knock-on effects from all this glucose?
Well, so that's why they only make the glucose once they start to freeze, because it's cold enough where they're not going to experience all that damage from walking around with all that sugar in your body. When we have diabetes and have high sugar blood glucose levels, high sugar levels in our blood, we can get damage to our proteins and the way our cells function. And so if it's cold enough, your body's not really functioning that much, so it's not going to be affected by those high levels of sugar. But as soon as we thaw out, then we got to reclaim those.
Gotcha. So essentially, it adds enough other stuff to the water in its cells that it is in the same way that, like, you can keep a bottle of vodka in the freezer and it's not going to freeze because the temperature isn't low enough to freeze alcohols, that it's keeping the water in its cells from freezing?
Yeah. So we're not going to see, we don't see in animals, there's a general rule with freeze tolerance that we don't see intracellular freezing. We don't see ice within the cell. Of course, there's debate amongst us about that because there might be a species of nematode, a worm, a very small worm that lives in Antarctica, that might be able to survive freezing within its cells. But that seems to be a very rare exception if it does exist.
And is the Alaskan wood frog alone in this, or is this a broad wood frog adaptation or a broad Alaskan adaptation?
So wood frogs actually have one of the widest distributions in North America, and they're all the way down. You could find them in DC. They go down to the Appalachian Mountains.
Wow.
And they all seem to be able to survive freezing, but there does seem to be a latitudinal gradient where the farther north species are more hardy and can survive longer. So we see our wood frogs able to survive down to about negative 20 Celsius and do that for about 7 months. So negative 20 is about negative 5 Fahrenheit, to give an idea to the listeners.
Amazing. Evolutionarily, the only other option basically is migration. Or are there other animals that do different things over winter besides just allow themselves to freeze or dig a hole? I mean, what's your other option?
That's a great question. So we can, you know, as you mentioned, migrate. We can stay active, which isn't really an option for an ectotherm, something that's cold-blooded. But for us mammals, we also have the option to hibernate. And that's where we don't lower our body temperature, but we lower our metabolic rate. So we burn less energy and then the body temperature follows. And we can greatly decrease our metabolic rate and then our energy needs for the winter doing this. And this is where, if we're talking Captain America, some of these hibernation things might come into play, where we have something similar that happens in humans called cold water near drowning, where especially young children seem to be able to survive for a very long time in frigid water without breathing and are able to come back because their body temperature is able to drop very quickly in response to that cold water and then survive that drowning event with no damage. But also with that, we have other species. So of course we have bears up here, but we also have a species called called the Arctic ground squirrel, who also hibernates, but it hibernates in the north and in Fairbanks. And since it's so small, it can't really maintain a high body temperature like bears do. They, you know, drop their body temperature a little bit, but they're still very warm. Arctic ground squirrels are a much smaller animal, and their body temperature gets below freezing, down to about -2 Celsius during winter.
Wow.
So we even have animals that are mammals, warm-blooded, that are able to maintain a below freezing body temperature. So we have those mechanisms for hibernators.
So the squirrel, though, doesn't actually, like, we don't see frozen water in the squirrel's body because it's not like pure water, which freezes right at 0 Celsius. It's got other stuff in it, glucose and other things. Same idea.
You have teed me up for that because water doesn't freeze at zero automatically. Water has a unique ability called supercooling. So if you've ever put a nice bottle of water in your freezer, and you can do this at home, something that's pure, the better, put it in your freezer, let the temperature drop overnight, go grab that bottle. It should still remain unfrozen, and then you shake it and it quickly nucleates and freezes. So that ground squirrel's blood actually remains super cool because its freezing point is slightly above that the low temperature it gets to. And that's how some ectotherms, cold-blooded things, survive winter too, by supercooling. So water will remain a liquid down to slightly below -40 Celsius. And again, for conversion purposes, -40 Celsius is about -40 Fahrenheit, also known as really cold.
What? -40? I thought you were going to say 4. Wow.
Yes. So water can remain unfrozen until -40 if you have a very, very small amount and a very pure amount. In Fairbanks, we see something called ice fog. That's when the water in the air freezes. And that happens about -20 or so Fahrenheit. We see water being able to maintain that. We have quite a few different species of insects that, like our wasps, our yellow jackets, actually will hang underneath leaves in the leaf litter on the ground and maintain a body temperature that's -20 Celsius without freezing. The moment you touch that animal with ice, though, it instantly freezes. Water needs something to build on to build ice. And if there's nothing there, if it's just pure water, that can't happen. And then to continue on this supercooling idea, we also have proteins called antifreeze proteins. So we have already, we have hibernation, we have freezing, we have supercooling, but then we have this another group called antifreeze proteins that bind to ice as it forms and prevents it from growing. And so we have insects here, specifically cucugis beetles, these larvae that can survive well below -40 without freezing. They can actually vitrify. They create a glass-like state in their body with these proteins binding to ice. And I believe the coldest they've ever gotten them to is -100, but the conditions for freezing them was in a vacuum chamber, so they couldn't really exactly test if they are alive. But they did prove that they couldn't freeze, basically.
If we can extrapolate to Captain America some of these adaptations, and if I'm in the military or a quasi-military organization like SHIELD and I'm trying to create a super soldier, maybe I want him... Maybe I'm thinking ahead of World War II into potential wars in Russia. So I'm going to actually build some of these adaptations into my serum. It doesn't actually sound crazy to do some genetic modification so I can get my soldier to run around in the cold. But it sounds like all these organisms are still essentially motionless during this time. This isn't like I can still go hunting in the cold. Is that true? Or are there any of these that manage to lower their body temperatures to very cold temperatures and still are somewhat active? Or is this a torpor sort of thing?
Well, everything I've talked about so far is torpor, but we do have Antarctic ice fish that do exist with antifreeze proteins in them and are very active at -2 Celsius.
Okay, there's your answer. Captain America is not part frog. He's part Antarctic ice fish.
Yes, so we have that. So we have all these different ways he could survive. He could be cold water near drowning. He could hibernate. He could be super cooled. He could be frozen, or he could produce his own antifreeze proteins.
Okay, well, question solved. I was going to say right into Marvel, but they don't care.
What we're talking about sounds more like with the ice fish, for example, genetic splicing or something, as opposed to an injection of some serum.
Yeah, I have a future concept for an episode is to get someone who works or studies genetic engineering to talk about the super soldier serum and see if we can make some sort of connection to on the fly in a single organism, not its offspring, genetic engineering, which, as far as I'm aware, isn't a thing.
Well, I'd like to point out that Watson and Crick figured out DNA in the 1950s. So they would have a concept of what genes are, but wouldn't have a concept of what DNA is.
Well, as far as the public knows, I mean, S.H.I.E.L.D. could have been way ahead. Who knows? Yeah, they certainly didn't have CRISPR or anything like gene editing tools like we're working with today. They did mention some failed tests, so there might be some frozen fish people in S.H.I.E.L.D.'s basement. That's a sentence I never thought I would say before this podcast started.
Is the wood frog the only amphibian that has this trait?
No, there are other freeze-tolerant amphibians. We have, dependent on what you count, 6 to 7 in North America. None of them have the endurance of the wood frog. We do have a couple species of Siberian salamanders that seem to be able to survive to very cold temperatures as well, with some experiments showing that they can survive down to negative 35. But they only used 3 animals for that, so it's a little bit difficult to figure out what their actual lower lethal temperatures are. But they did show survival for some of them down to very cold. And we would expect those species to also be able to survive frozen for, 6 to 7 months like we see in Alaska.
In theory, if you took an Alaskan wood frog and froze it for 70 years, is there a difference to the frog between those 6 months and those 70 years? Or is this a stable state it's in?
This is where you can go into your freezer and show why this might be an issue. What happens to ice cream if it's in a freezer for months?
Oh, freezer burn.
That poor guy.
Freezer burn frog.
So we might have that issue where the freezer is an extreme example because the temperatures fluctuate, right? It cools off and warms up and that causes that humidity to form. But we get recrystallization of ice, and that's what freezer burn is. So ice changes its shape as it's frozen. It doesn't just stay there. So you'd need a stable system that's going to maintain and be very dry and prevent any recrystallization of ice. So we don't know how long wood frogs can remain frozen at this time. When we've frozen wood frogs outside in Fairbanks, we had what's kind of an annoying but great result. Annoying in that it didn't give us a limit. So we froze all our frogs and we had 100% survival over the whole winter outside. So we couldn't really extrapolate, well, how long can they do it? Because they all survive. But we know it's at least 6 to 7 months. Wow. Could it be longer? Yes. Would I expect a year? I think that'd be a bit much. But it's an experiment that still needs to be done.
This year, especially, I think, well, I'm making this up, but I think a lot of people have fantasized for a moment about going to sleep and waking up when this all blows over, frozen or otherwise. Adam, if you could freeze yourself for 70 years and wake up in whatever world exists in 2091, would you take the chance? Before you answer, let me assume that you can take your family with you.
You've been asleep, Cap, for almost 70 years. You going to be okay?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a date.
Okay. So what would intrigue me about this is I would be really curious about what the future would look like 70 years from now. And that would be a pretty driving motivation for wanting to do this. At the same time, I think there's too much one leaves behind. Even if you look at Captain America, the world is not the way it was when he crashed the plane. And 70 years later, there was a major adjustment. There's also, of course, no guarantee that the world, forget being the same, will even still be there.
That's a fair point.
I think I'm happy where I am.
Don, how about you? Would you pull a mini Futurama, jump ahead in time to experience the future?
Well, I'm just thinking of how hard it would be to explain 2020 to somebody from 2010. I can't imagine how hard it would be to try and recognize the world 70 years from now.
Oh, geez, that's actually the scariest way to think about it. If 2020 is hard to explain to 2010, then what is 2030 going to be like? Oh, no. It is worth pointing out, actually, as Adam said, that Steve Rogers is chock full of regrets. And the end of his story is going back in time when he can, / universe hopping, to return to more or less where he left off. So it seems like he didn't enjoy the experience overall.
I went in the ice in 45 right after I met the love of my life. And woke up 70 years later.
Next up, we have a segment in the show. This is a real segment called, technically. I actually, by the way, do push up my glasses every time I say that. Adam and I are going to keep quiet as Don gives us some nuance or details on anything related even tangentially to the topic. Don, you have the floor.
Well, so I think it's possible for us to create some super soldier possibly to survive hibernation conditions. We are spending a lot of time researching how to hibernate people, and we have evidence of things like cold water near drowning where we have individuals able to survive cold temperatures. I don't think what we have with Steve Rogers, though, would be possible if he's above ground. I think if he's frozen in the ocean, you could make a scientific explanation of how this possibly could happen with his super healing factors or things like that. But once we get into the air, that's when we need things like those antifreeze proteins mentioned earlier. That seems to require too much of a little bit of a scientific leap, unless they had some way to create and know about both how DNA functions and how proteins function, and antifreeze proteins, which were something that was only discovered in the 1960s. They would have to have all that knowledge prior to putting Steve Rogers, giving him that super serum that wouldn't exist. We would know, though, during the 1940s about hibernation. We would know about cold water near drowning. We might even have a couple scientists that would be aware that there's animals that might be able to freeze, although most of that work was, again, done in the 50s and 60s. But we wouldn't have seen too much of that. One thing I would like to point out, too, is we would have had scientists in Alaska that probably would have been part of something like, how do we get somebody to survive freezing? The military had a base called Point Barrow. They had research scientists looking at how animals survive winter. And two of the really famous ecophysiologists there were Pierre Scholander and Lawrence Irving. And they looked into freeze tolerance and how animals survived freeze tolerance and started to develop some of that science. So if there was a push to create a super soldier that could survive freezing or survive hibernation, you probably would have had both those guys involved. And just to add to this, there would have been a need and a desire to have something like a super soldier that could hibernate. Not because you want them to survive when their plane crashes, but if you can put somebody in a hibernative state when they're injured, you can help them heal quicker. When we're hibernating, when bears hibernate, when ground squirrels are a really great example of this, they have a lowered metabolism. So things like inflammation happen at a slower rate. We even see with the ground squirrel that you can give a ground squirrel, an arctic ground squirrel, a stroke, and it's very resilient to it because it's adapted to having a very slow moving circulatory system and slow moving blood during hibernation, as its heart's only beating once per minute. So it can survive things like strokes, TBIs that might not be survivable because it's in its hibernative state. So although I'm the wood frog expert and really want things to freeze, I would say that they probably wouldn't have been on to freeze tolerance for something like a Captain America, but would have tried to figure out some way to have this hibernative adaption in him so he could survive severe injuries. They could put him on ice, cool him off, and repair whatever injuries those were, and then warm him back up as they need to.
I did not think of that as being actually a useful thing. I was thinking of fight in the cold, but not in the sense of surviving an injury. Adam, close us out. What are your final frozen thoughts?
Oh, man. Well, I find this whole topic fascinating. First of all, thanks for having me on the show and Don for your insights. Great to meet you. And I've learned a ton about cryoprotectants and antifreeze proteins. And I came into this thinking there was no way I would believe that this was possible. It would be completely fantastical. And I was fine with that because I'm happy with a good fantasy. But now I actually think that there's enough science behind it that there could be some way of recreating, maybe not for 70 years, but in small steps, some type of defrosted life. And then I would just add to that, that there is a lot of interesting stuff out there on bacteria and viruses. And how long they can survive frozen. And I believe there was a NASA study where they revived some bacteria that was like 32,000 years old. And again, this was from 10 minutes of Googling. So I can't claim that's 100% correct. I also find that fascinating. And what's the impact going to be with continued global warming and whether or not bacteria or viruses from various stages of being frozen under permafrost, what impact they may have upon the future.
Yeah, the concept of unfreezing a 32,000-year-old bacteria. I mean, it's literally the opening scene of, I'm sure, at least one sci-fi movie. So thanks, everybody, for giving me that nightmare. I want to be clear, as always, that I love these movies. Scientific accuracy is not a necessary component for good storytelling. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way. I want to thank my guests, Don Larson and Adam Correa, for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and cross your fingers there's an episode 11. That's all for this episode. Thanks once again to my guests, Adam Correa and Don Larson. Their ability to make these thin connections and the seriousness they gave their roles means a lot to me. I'm going to ask you a favor during the credits now. Share this podcast with one friend you think would like it. And if you want to go a step further, I'll ask what every small podcast asks, to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. MCU audio clips were taken from each of the solo Captain America movies, The Avengers, Avengers Endgame, Spider-Man Homecoming, and all used entirely without permission. Please don't sue me. The music is a song called On Tiptoe from Purple Planet Music. That song and more royalty-free music can be found at purple-planet.com. And not to brag, but just to clarify for the sake of the credits, all other aspects of the production, including research, writing, and editing, were done by me, Dave Reinersman. Check out more info about each episode and its guests, including upcoming episodes, at davereinersman.com/marvelsofscience. Thanks for listening! And last credit, that game show song is actually called Soul Train, also from Purple Planet Music.